From the National Endowment for the Arts, this is Artworks. I'm Josephine Reed. Today, we continue our celebration of Hispanic Heritage Month with a conversation with Tejano artist and teacher, Amalia Ortiz. Amalia is an award-winning performance poet, performer, and playwright. The author of two acclaimed collections of poetry, including the Canción Cannibal Cabaret and Other Songs, which doubles as a script for a punk rock musical, Amalia also directs the theater arts division at the acclaimed arts education program, SACE. Begun in 1994, SACE, which stands for San Antonio Youth Say Yes, is a year-round, long-term, tuition-free arts program for high school and middle school students, primarily from underserved communities. A recipient of the National Arts and Humanities Youth Program Award in 2002, SACE has some 200 students from over 70 schools in its on-site programs, while reaching thousands more Bexar County students through its outreach programs. Amalia Ortiz joined me to talk about her work at SACE, her own extraordinary art, and the intersection between the two. We began by talking about the on-site programs offered by SACE.
We have four different studios for two different age groups. We have our middle school program we call WAM, Working Artists and Mentors, and then our high school students. And the WAM students get to choose two of the four studios. So we have visual arts, what you think of as a traditional arts class, drawing, painting, sculpting. We have media arts, which is photography and filmmaking and some digital artwork. And then there's the Hive, and they focus on video games. They do coding. They do more computer type arts, but then they also do more experimental arts. They just did a sound installation, and they also cover gaming and graphic novels. And then there's the theater arts studio that I work in.
Let's talk in some detail about the work you do in the theater arts program.
I'm proud to say that all of the work that our theater produces is all written by the students. So I have middle school students and high school students. So I'm very much a facilitator, asking questions. We're given a theme, and so we do research first. Right now we're researching Dia de los Muertos, and then I ask a bunch of questions, like, what do you have to say that's different from all the other media out there about Dia de los Muertos? And then we start writing, and really it's the students dictating to me. I'm at a computer, and I do shape it. I do talk to them about the structure of a play, the exposition, introduction of the characters, rising action, main conflict, falling action, all of that, so that definitely by the time they graduate high school, they are playwrights. And that is deliberate. Based on my experience as an actor, you can get frustrated waiting around, waiting for the callback, waiting to be cast, or you can create your own work in your own voice about topics that you care most about. And that's the main idea that I try to impress upon all my students, is that they have agency to tell their own stories.
Who are the students in theater arts, but at SACE more generally? Where do they typically come from? Who are they?
So they're coming from all over San Antonio. The program is highly recognized, so it can be competitive. We have interviews about two times a year, and we do want to interview our students to make sure that they are serious, that they're committed, because there is a time commitment involved, especially in theater. Pre-pandemic, we tried to keep our numbers at 70% at or below the poverty level. And so that other 30%, it becomes competitive with people who are above the poverty level but are competing to get into the program. Then we really have to discuss their portfolios, what they have to offer, what they can share with our other students.
And I've read that alumni often go on to have an important role at SACE.
Yes, we engage with our alumni so much. Our alumni are often hired. We have an ABC program, and that's the Artists and Communities, where it's kind of a mini SACE where they go into the schools. And then we also have our WAM program is Working Artists and Mentors. We hire some of our high school students to come into the middle school program to be mentors so that they also are exposed to get experience with leading young students so that they can also graduate high school with some sort of teaching experience on their resume. And I've had students that have gone on to get degrees in theater and they are teachers now, and they remember their first experiences in the classroom when they were in high school at SACE.
And you also serve many students in community programs. How are they different from the programs that you actually house, or are they an extension of them? How does that work?
So that is usually our alumni. Most of the ABC instructors are alumni, and they are going into the schools. And so it is different in that they are going into the public schools. And I used to do workshops in the public schools, and I feel like it's taking the art to everybody. I feel like with SACE students, we have students that want to be there. They are already drawn to arts. It can be more difficult going into an after-school program in a school where sometimes students are only there because their parents don't want to pick them up until after six. And so my mom made me do this thing. And so I feel like it's a harder audience. I've worked that kind of audience before. I think it is just equally as valuable, if not more so, because some students have no clue that they're artists. They just haven't been exposed to it, and they need that exposure to something different. And it is a shame that there's so many schools where they're cutting back on the arts. And so there are more and more students that have never taken an art class. They have no idea what that is. So when we talk about what medium are you interested in, they don't even understand that question. It's like, okay, there's painting, there's acrylic and oil, there's pastels, there's charcoal. And there's students who just really, when they think of art, it really is restricted to the materials that they come across on a daily basis, you know, pens, Sharpies, markers. And sometimes even just exposing a student to a new medium can just really wake up their imagination.
SACE has grown so much since it began in 1994. And in fact, you just moved into a new building, which apparently has a big gallery space and it looks like a gorgeous new theater. Are you open for business? Is that open yet?
So we are open. We moved in last August and we were working with architect and we had these plans to have our old building, I had a black box. So in the expansion, I was going to have a black box plus a theater acting studio plus a proscenium theater. Plus we wanted to have outside performance spaces. And then the pandemic hit and some funders were not able to continue with funding. Some funders' interest changed. As we all know, during the pandemic, the priority became feeding people and housing people. And so we are slowly building back our program. We have moved into the new studio, but I want to say it is probably about five times larger than SACE, and that's just a guesstimate. And we have renovated one-fifth of it so far. And so there are four big studios. So instead of a black box, I do have a large theater space. But I come from the tradition of Chicano theater. I come from the tradition of definitely the show must go on. I've done theater in found spaces, in backyards. And it is still a beautiful room, and it is a big room. But with me, my challenge has been, how do we treat this as a black box, rehanging some of the old theater curtains and rethinking seating? We used to have a technical booth. And so instead of a booth, where is the best place to set our sound and light booth? So if you have a big room, how do you convert any big room into a theater? We've already had two large productions in that space. Our next Muertitos Fest, we have a really great, huge loading dock that takes up the length of the entire building. Last Muertitos Fest, we had a band out there. This Muertitos Fest, we're going to have performances out there. So it is really rethinking theater. We're learning to do lights on trees that are movable so we can set up lights and roll them out onto that loading dock and then roll them in. But we are in the middle of a capital campaign, and the goal is to have the rest of the building renovated, and eventually I will have a black box, and I think the goal is still to have eventually a state-of-the-arts proscenium theater.
So the students are also learning behind-the-scenes skills, as well as playwriting and performing and directing. They're also learning all the crafts that go into making a production.
Yes. I approach the program very similar to everything that I learned in my bachelor's program. And so we do workshops in design, costume and set. We do workshops in stage management, in lights and sound. And not every student is good at everything, but they will gravitate towards those areas of theater that they have a special interest in. A student will ask, I really want to do costume design, or I have an idea for set, or I really want to paint a backdrop. And it really is their theater troupe. And they come to me with ideas. And you know, I will ask, okay, so what are your set ideas? In the past with Muertitos Fest, when it has been like 3 or 4 day festival, our students are all stagehands and they learn how to help bands with microphones, cables, how to strike a set quickly, how to set it back up. And then we have stage management. But, you know, as students of theater, by the time they're in high school, they get to see it all. And then their capstone project, every senior has to do a senior show. And I think the majority of the projects have been a student writes a play and then they cast it and they direct it. But we have had this past senior show, we had a student who was more interested in performance art and installation. So she built a giant blanket fort. And then she had a performance inside. The inside of the blanket fort was made to look like a teenage room. So it was very messy with clothing everywhere. But she also had comfortable rugs and pillows and a big soft chair. And she had her performers take turns sitting in the chair, reading out of a book like it was story time. And so the audience would come in and find a place on the floor and sit and listen to a story. All of our seniors have to produce an artist statement and bio along with that. And her artist statement, she explained how some of her first performances were in that blanket fort. And she wanted her audience to feel that intimacy of that kind of micro performance in a small space.
So it sounds like such an interesting combination of a really rigorous program that nonetheless is very tailored to each student.
It is open to what they want to do with it. And actually, like right now, the last couple of days, I've been doing team building with my students. And I ask, why are you drawn to theater? Why are you drawn to the arts? What do you want to get out of it? What do you have to say? Who is your community? And what do you have to offer your community? I'm very community minded because I look at like this pyramid. And if you think of the arts as a pyramid at the top, especially with theater and actors, it's the A-listers. It's the people on Broadway. It's people who are doing the million-dollar films. But at the bottom of this pyramid, this triangle, is the everyday theater makers who are working, you know, every day in community theaters, who are working in found spaces, who are working in educational theater. And all of these theater workers deserve dignity. And in speaking with my students, you know, I tell them, you can wait around to be discovered. You can go through the mainstream American route of creating theater. And as an actor, you are a dime a dozen. Or while you're waiting to be cast and while you're working on your craft, you can also work on telling your stories. And if you aren't necessarily the best writer, you can have a community of friends where, oh, that person is a good writer and that person is a great director and that person is a great tech person, and work with them to create your own stories. I really encourage them to create original theater because that was the route for me that has given me probably my entire career. I owe to the community that I've worked with in San Antonio and that has opened up networks actually throughout the United States for me.
We mentioned COVID and what it meant for the building, the construction of the inside of the building. What else did it mean for CC? How are you responding to it?
When I think back on the year and a half that we were teaching arts online, I don't know how we got through it, but we did. And so it really was signing on through Zoom for the students, trying to offer them some sort of light in that very dark time. It was such an unimaginable storm that we weathered. I could say from the theater point of view, we became filmmakers. because we were doing it over Zoom. So we were thinking more of the camera lens. How do you act to a camera lens? And so coming back into the classroom, it is reminding them you have to project. You're using your whole body. Most of the students, the high school students that I had graduated or dropped out of the program. And so when we came into the building, it really is a whole new group of students that maybe didn't have any kind of arts training during the pandemic. And so it is a lot of 101. I do see smaller attention spans. I get it. Students are traumatized. And obviously getting back into school is a struggle. And so it is a slow build to reintroduce what is a discipline to them. And I've had that conversation with them. While you're here, I'm really asking for your focus and your commitment and your time. And our classes are actually shorter and fewer. We used to have high school students 4 days a week. Now I only have them for 2 days a week. And part of that is it really is us trying to be open to families who are still recovering from COVID, who have transportation issues, who have illness in the family. We have students who are working and we understand that. And so really being more open to doing what we can with the time we have. And it's pretty difficult doing theater on just 2 or 3 days a week, but we are still moving forward and we're still making it happen.
Well, I mean, it's been such a time, and in San Antonio, you're not just dealing with COVID and the racial reckoning the whole country is dealing with, but you're dealing with issues that are going on the border and with immigration. And I have to believe this isn't just an abstract issue for many of the students and teachers.
It's a very personal issue to me. I grew up on the border. I am I almost said my grandparents were immigrants, but actually that goes back to my grandfather. He was in the Mexican Revolution and settled in South Texas. And this was before the Treaty of Guadalupe. And then, you know, literally the border crossed him when the borderline moved, but they were considered immigrants and treated like immigrants. And so I have had students who are immigrants. The majority of our student body, I would say they are Mexican Americans. They do have that history of immigration and also the attitudes that those in power have towards Mexican Americans and Mexicans here in Texas and San Antonio specifically. We are a social justice organization. So, for example, we have Muertitos Fest coming up, and all of my students, whether they're Mexican American or not, I explain that this is a cultural holiday and we're studying it as that. It began as definitely a religious and spiritual holiday, but we're looking at it from a cultural lens. And I would say that every project, I'm asking them, what are their stories? We've had projects where I ask them to interview their grandparents and we hear those immigration stories. If we have bilingual students, those are skills that I want to have on stage. And so I ask them to use their bilingualism. We did a show where all the students had to interview someone. So we studied Anna Deavere Smith. After we studied her and watched Twilight, students had to go and interview people from their homes. And then they had to interview them on video. And then that really is a one-on-one acting exercise where you have to imitate that voice and those movements. And you have a video that you can really play again and again, trying to get as close to that original as possible. That first time we did that exercise, it yielded a show called Hear Me Out. And we had two different students whose monologues were in Spanish. And one of them specifically was a young student who talked about his dad's story of crossing the border. And it's monologue saying, and then I met your mother, and then we moved to Houston. But all of this was in Spanish. And so these are the stories that the students are bringing to the stage. And I'm so proud of their bravery. And that's why I encourage them that they have to tell their own stories. They are playwrights. They are storytellers. I just need to ask questions and then stand back and listen to their stories.
Well, in your poetry, you're often telling your own story. And I'm curious how growing up in the borderlands in Texas shaped your work and continues to shape your work.
It was the strongest influence on my life and therefore and my writing and my art. I grew up, I think, technically 3 miles from the border. There was no border crossing there, but 3 miles from the river, people would cross there. People would float across and then run through these agricultural fields. I grew up in a home where my grandparents only spoke Spanish to me, but they believed that I would do better in this country if I spoke English. And so I speak newscasts. I was a radio announcer. I speak perfect English. And, you know, it's a plus and minus. My Spanish is not so good because I didn't really practice it, but I'm fluent in understanding it. That comes out in my writing. There are certain words that have more meaning to me in Spanish than when I say them in English. I've written about that. I've written about code switching. I've written about the personalities, the characters that I grew up maybe not even understanding, not having context for some of the characters until I was able to leave and go back. My last book, The Canción Cannibal Cabaret, is more abstract from the border, but it is still very much about the border. It's set in a post-apocalyptic landscape, and the reality is the border is post-apocalyptic. When I was working on my graduate degree at UTRGV, and that I was mainly in the campus there in Edinburgh, they asked for students to volunteer time to go to a refugee shelter, and this was in Mission, Texas. And this was the summer of the unaccompanied minor, and they were calling it, it was a border crisis. And going and volunteering time so impacted me to remind me that apocalyptic reality that does exist for so many people, for immigrants, refugees globally. That is the reality of so many people globally. And so that's where the idea for the Canción Cannibal Cabaret came from. So it is a punk rock musical, and one of the first poem songs came from me moving back to the border. This was after I had lived away from the border for 25 years. I would definitely visit, but I had lived in LA for 5 years and then moved back to the Brownsville area and was shocked to see the border wall. Now, there was some sort of border wall when I was growing up, but it was more of a fence. But this new thing, it's just so ominous. And to see the length of that, and to realize most of my adult life, I looked back on this region through nostalgia as a person who survived something. It was safely in my past. So the move back and I see this wall, I immediately wanted to write about it. The idea for my second book came out of that.
You're a performance poet, but as we've said, you have two books of poetry. Is there a difference between performance poetry and written poetry? I mean, I have my own ideas, and a lot of it has to do, I would think, with emphasis, but I'm curious what your thoughts are.
I definitely believe so. I came to poetry as a performer. I had my bachelor's in theater. My brother was in Chicago, and so he really exposed me in my visits to him to the Chicago slam poetry and spoken word scene they have. It's legendary. And I remember some of the first visits seeing punk rock poets yelling and pounding their fists and going up and down the aisles of a bookstore or a coffee shop, or poets speaking as though they're in a tent revival. And as an actor, that made sense to me. And especially as someone, I write my own words, I want to perform them with the energy that I feel that, you know, they are due. They're special to me. And so that's how I want to perform them. I have gone through a graduate program, and there's times when I've had assignments where I have to really look at the page. That is something that I noticed. I wasn't really looking at what my stanzas looked like on page. I really didn't care about them because I was just writing to memorize. And if you look at an anthology of slam poetry, it's often left justified, and then it's short phrases. And it's short phrases because that's how we memorize. I will memorize 4 to 5 words at a time. And that's also how we breathe. And so lines are usually broken up by how they sound when we're speaking them. And so I had to rethink what makes an interesting stanza, line breaks, how you can break a line in the middle of a sentence or a phrase to create a different layer if you're reading it as on the page as opposed to reading it out loud. Yeah, they are very different.
Your second book, The Canción Cannibal Cabaret, is a themed collection of poetry, as you said, set in a post-apocalyptic landscape. And it's also the script for a punk rock musical. It's both. And you've performed it a number of times.
Yes.
So how is performing it and giving this full voice?
When I first wrote it, I was writing it for someone else to perform. I thought, I'll find someone with a great voice and I will direct it. But it was my master's thesis. And speaking with my chair at UTRGV, I would meet with her maybe once a month and give her updates and explain to her how the project was changing and evolving. But I definitely wanted it to be. And it is a defense of performance poetry and performance. And all along, I saw it with costumes and lights and movement and choreography, even though it begins with poetry. And so in graduating, I'd set up a date for the thesis defense, but I said, I need to stage it. And my chair was like, you don't really have to. I'm like, but I have to so that you can see what it is, because you've only been reading it. I remember all the actors in the theater department were all busy with their finals. So I found students from the Mexican American Studies program there at UTRGV. They're sitting around like, hey, you're going to be in my musical. You're going to be in my musical. So I got a theater on campus, put it on, and I remember inviting my professors to it. They needed to understand it's this three-dimensional work and not this flat book. And so it is about an army of women who have had enough, and they're going to defend themselves and their families and marginalized communities. And one of the best compliments I got was from one of my other professors. She said, I want to join your army. And I said, yes, that is the goal. I want the work to galvanize people to feel like they have agency and standing alone, we are powerless. But the agency comes from when you connect to a community and we decide we are going to make changes.
Are you still giving performances of it?
Yes. For 2 years, we were in the pandemic, but we are once again out and touring it. We actually performed at Barcelona at a conference this summer, and we are invited to our next performance is in San Marcos at a film festival.
You won the American Book Award in 2020, certainly in large part due to the Canción Cannibal Cabaret. Many congratulations. Tell me a little bit about that award.
I have Rudolfo Anaya to thank for that. Shortly after the book was published by Aztlan Libre Press, my publisher was sending out copies, trying to get people to review it, to read it, to know that it existed. And I got the most amazing handwritten letter from Rudolfo Anaya saying, I hope she wins awards. And then saying the introduction to the book was worth the price. And that's where I lay out my case. I talk about my influences coming from spoken word. I talk about my experience in the classroom when people say your work is didactic. And it's like, well, it is a teaching tool. And I see how in poetry at that time, it wasn't in vogue. Political poetry wasn't in vogue. You don't want something that hits you over the head that's too on the nose. On the nose was a bad thing. You want to be more obscure and more subtle in your poetry. So I wrote this whole defense, really just explaining my aesthetics. And Rudolfo Anaya said he loved the introduction, loved the poetry. It's embarrassing to repeat, but he said, Amalia Ortiz is a genius.
And to hear that from Rudolfo Anaya, that must have been so gratifying.
And this was the year before he passed. And it's heartbreaking that I never got to meet him. But I know that he was on the board of the American Book Award as before Columbus Foundation. And I'm certain that it had to have been him who took the book and gave it to the organization when they are looking at what books to consider. And I just know that it was through his influence that he brought it to their attention. So the award is actually for oral literature. And so I don't know if it's specifically for the book, but it is an award for me for my defense of oral literature. And I think very much it is the book because it is the book with the introduction that defends spoken word in academia and is carving out a corner for it in academia, why it should be studied. I know that for many years, there are people who didn't think much of slam poetry or performance poetry. I heard myself in workshops, your writing relies on theatrics. And it's like, well, I don't rely on theatrics, but theatrics is definitely a part of my work. And I don't see that as a negative. I see that as adding. It becomes this, it's this other thing. But yes, the book was honored from the Before Columbus Foundation, and I was given an award for my work in oral literature.
Your resume is astounding. And I'm curious, what led you to teaching? Was teaching something you always wanted to do? How did you move to teaching? And does teaching and writing for you revitalize one another, or are they very separate spheres?
So when I was in graduate school, I remember we had a class in professional development and we had to write out a syllabus and think about ourselves as professors. And I kind of knew all along, I don't want to be a professor. I don't want to be a college professor. And my issues are, I don't want to be putting grades on people's creative work. And I would always say in class, I was getting my graduate degree because I was more interested in practical application. I want to write and I want to perform and I want to produce original theater and I want to be in original theater. And I just really lucked out. When I interviewed at SAC and I realized they're working on these long-term projects and that all of our projects are creating original scripts. I got so excited because that's exactly what I want. I want practical application where it is just show after show. To me, that's exciting as a teacher, where I could show these students what I really do in life. I spend months researching until I settle on a theme, and then I spent months writing. And then once it's written, I spend a lot of time rehearsing. And that really is the schedule with our students. We spend about a month researching a theme and a month writing and then a month rehearsing. And to me, it's exciting because I see it as I'm a producer. I get to produce all of this original theater. And to me, that's practical application. I'm not giving them writing assignments and then reading them and grading them and giving them back. You know, we'll do writing workshops and we'll critique each other's work, but then I push them to follow through. I don't want them to crumple up that assignment or to get lost in some folder that they never use again. It's like, okay, so what are you going to do with this piece now? Now you've written it. Now you've edited it. Now we're going to have an open mic. Now there are these local competitions you can submit it in. Every year our students submit to the Scholastic Awards, and we just finished a script and I was speaking with a student just yesterday saying, you were the lead writer on that project. You need to submit it to Scholastic. And so it's setting up realistic practices as a writer and as an artist. And to me, that's exciting. I love that I am training young artists. That to me is exciting.
Well, I was going to ask you how success as a teacher looks for you, how you would define that, but I think you just answered that.
I would say I've had students that are going on and they're producing their own theater, and to me, that's the best. I love going to see my students perform, and they're doing it. They are publishing. Students who weren't sure that they should go to college are going to college, or students who weren't sure if the arts was something for them that are continuing the arts, even though they're not majoring in the arts. To me, that's exciting, is that they are taking their art seriously, their voices seriously, they're using their voices.
And what about for your own work, Amalia? What feels successful for you, the way you define success?
Wow, that's a lot harder. I have recognition. I know I can do it. But as an artist, I still have those moments of self-doubt. I still struggle with imposter syndrome. I cannot think of success. I have to think of what do I have to say? And I would say daily, as I'm living my life, there's still issues where I feel powerless. And those are the issues I feel most inclined to write about. If I feel like I can't change it, I'm at least going to write about it so that maybe it connects with the community out there and the community can start to change it. That's what gives me hope. That's success to me.
And I think that is a good place to leave it. Amalia, thank you. Thank you for all the work you do. Oh, and a big shout out for the video you did for Poetry Out Loud about strategies that students should be thinking about when they're reciting their poems. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much for this interview. It really is an honor to be interviewed and to give me time as an artist to reflect on my work and to remember what it is I'm doing and why I'm doing it. So thank you.
That was poet, performer, and playwright Amalia Ortiz. Amalia directs the Theater Arts Division at the Arts Education Program, SAC, in San Antonio. Find out more about the organization at SAC.org. And you can keep up with Amalia, her poetry, and upcoming performances of the Canción Cannibal Cabaret, as well as see videos of her poetry performances at AmaliaOrtiz.net. You've been listening to Artworks, produced at the National Endowment for the Arts. Follow Artworks wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a rating on Apple because it helps people to find us. And as always, we'd love to know your thoughts about the podcast. Send us an email at artworkspod@arts.gov. For the National Endowment for the Arts, I'm Josephine Reed. Thanks for listening.